This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Often when I screen this film, I say, this is not your standard documentary film. And so I'm saying it to you, but maybe I don't need to say it to you because I have the feeling that you're open to different forms of filmic production. But in fact, Eduardo Cohn, the co-director, and I call it an experimental ethnographic film, precisely because it tries to say something through its form as well as through its content. Thus, it's an attempt to disrupt any kind of straightforward historical narrative that you might expect or be looking for in a kind of more, what I'm calling a more standard documentary film. And instead, it's trying to suggest that history is always haunting our present, as a dream or a nightmare might. And that that's the first thing. And then it's also trying to suggest that communication is never as straightforward as we might like to think. And so in a blurb that I wrote about Unknown Parts, I said, it's attempting to visually and sonically, so both through images and sounds, or visual images and sounds, capture the Inuit experience of being forced to leave their home communities and live for an undetermined period of time in a southern sanatorium. And so what's difficult about making a film like this is that you don't want to minimize the humanitarian crisis of the TB epidemic, that the TB epidemic posed for the Canadian state. But what the film is really trying to do is to explore the experience of rupture and dislocation caused by those policies, caused by the policies of the Canadian state in the face of this humanitarian crisis. So rather than a straightforward expository narrative, it hopes to capture one of the most striking aspects that that very dislocation took, which was that the possibility of communication, both verbal and nonverbal, was put into question. So what do I mean by that? Inuit often found that words escaped them when they tried to write or send spoken messages across the miles that now separated from them from their families in this, when they were in the sanatoriums in the south and their family members were in the Arctic. The words that they did send to each other were often met by silence. Letters and tapes were lost in transit. The recipient died before the letters arrived. The person in the north never got the letter. The person in the south had been transferred to another hospital. And in some cases, the silence persists today. In the cases of those who never returned, some family members actually still hold out hope that they will someday hear news of their whereabouts, so even today. So in 2015, so 3 years ago, supported by funds from the SSHRC, which is a Canadian granting agency, we screened a rough cut of this film in Arctic Bay and Iqaluit, the two communities that you'll see represented in the film. And at the same time, we captured some additional footage for the final cut of the film. It's not an easy film to watch, and the responses to the film were gratifying because people both got, you know, responded to the difficulty of the film and the importance of speaking out about what happened. I think the film is difficult to watch for two reasons. One, it tries to capture some of the violence of colonialism through the words of colonial agents, and that's very painful. It's painful to hear those voices. But I think that it's one of the only ways that we have to really communicate what we call the violence of friendliness. So you'll hear the colonial agents being very friendly and at the same time very violent. Number two, I think it's a difficult film because watching family members express the pain of separation on film was very difficult. It's difficult for all of us, but it's more difficult when it's your own family member. So one last thing that I want to say about Into Foreign Parts is that it's not a film in the participatory filmmaking genre, although I've done that kind of work with Inuit youth. Instead, this particular film attempts, in the words of filmmaker Trinh Minh Ha, to speak nearby, to add our voices to the voices of the people with whom I have worked for many years. And in fact, I wanted to say that this film is inspired by Freud's assertion that dreams are nothing if not a form of thinking in images. And what's radical about that statement is that dreams are a form of thinking. And so imagistic thinking, which is what happens, imagistic and associational thinking, which is what happens in dreams, is also a very important form of thinking in our lives. So the film tries to find a way to stay with the images, sound and visual images, and not to translate them too quickly into familiar discursive forms. How do the archival sounds and images of that time, the 1950s and 60s in the Canadian Arctic, as well as the contemporary images of tuberculosis survivors, how do those images move us on a level that's not constrained by our everyday sense of history? Is such a history ever really past? The philosopher Wittgenstein, in his writing on Freud, says that to interpret a dream is to dream the dream again in a new context. So to interpret a dream is to dream the dream again in a new context. And for us, filmmaking is also like Wittgenstein's dream interpretation. We're dreaming the dream that each image holds within it again. I thought I might focus on the recording you hear of a husband, Ituk, speaking to his wife, Akikiakchuk, in hospital. And we hear the audio recording over a black screen with subtitles. And then we hear it once again when you hear the man who was a baby in the recording listening to it for the first time 50 years later. So I wanted to first just give a little context. So as I said at the beginning, and the film also emphasizes, getting messages to and from Inuit in the hospital was really difficult. And so beginning the history of the tuberculosis treatment was that beginning in the 1940s, a team of doctors, x-ray technicians, nurses, and finally by the end of the 1950s, a social worker accompanied what was then called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Patrol, which took place on the C.D. Howe, which is the boat that you hear referred to several times in the film. And this boat would go to each of the Arctic settlements, screening each of the inhabitants of each settlement for tuberculosis. Anyone who tested positive was kept aboard the ship to begin passage south to Sanatoria. Inuit often ended up spending several years in Sanatoria down south, and there were no telephones in Inuit homes. And the mail came only sporadically. At times, it only came once a year. So families who had never been apart and who, generally speaking, slept together on the same platform in the sod houses in the summer or in the igloos in the winter, so had never been separated, were separated for years with little means of communication and little knowledge of what was happening to their family members. Inuit who died in hospital were usually buried in unmarked graves in the nearby cemetery. And although hospital staff tried to inform the families of their deaths, there was often much confusion about their identity, especially about the identity of the children. So you see an image in there, a photograph of children with name tags on. And so this was an attempt to try to rectify the problem that many children went missing, and the news of their deaths didn't reach their parents because they didn't know who they were. Hospital administrators, like some Northern Service officers, could not speak Inuktitut and had no clear sense of Arctic geography. There were also stories of children being removed from the hospital and not being sent back to their parents, being placed instead in foster homes without the permission or even knowledge of their parents. Those stories seem to have no end. One man I interviewed in Arctic Bay returned home to find out that his atik, or name soul, had been given away. His parents had understood that after a certain number of years, when he didn't return, he was dead. And so his name, which is also your soul in the Inuit tradition, was given to another child. Another young boy returned home and realized he could no longer speak to his parents. He'd forgotten how to speak Inuktitut. So by the 1960s, the Canadian administration was beginning to realize, mostly because Inuit started writing letters and petitioning the administration, what a toll this practice of removing Inuit from their communities was taking on Inuit families. So they bought a tape recorder and a reel of tape to send with the medical team to go on this Eastern Arctic patrol. So the tape that I found that you hear in this audio image that I'm talking about was in the Hamilton McMaster Health Services archive, and it was recorded in 1961. And the tape, the only name on the tape is Eastern Arctic Patrol. And so far, I've only found one existing audio tape, but I've read several other transcriptions that were made of audio tapes. I have never met anyone who received a message. So they were recording them. Somehow they were making their way down south, but I've never met anyone who actually heard a message that was intended for them. The tape in that the tape in the archive that I found contains five messages from family members in the communities of Lake Harbor, Arctic Bay, Pond Inlet, and Clyde River to patients in the Hamilton Sanatorium in Ontario, approximately 2,000 miles away. As you heard, each message is recorded in Inuktitut. It's introduced by the voice of a nurse speaking in English. Each message is numbered. Each speaker is identified by his or her Inuktitut name along with a government-issued disc number, something that I talk about quite extensively in the book, Life Beside Itself. The intended recipient of the message is also named, and a disc number is also given. So we get a kind of very visceral example of also the kind of anonymous care that I talk about in Life Beside Itself. So many people had a hard time finding words to speak into the recorder. For example, a daughter says to her mother, "I don't know what to say, Mom, so I'm just going to say hello and bye, Mom." This sense of not knowing what to say is repeated over and over. And so as a result of working with these recordings, I've become very interested in what it means to send one's voice across or into these absences that are a kind of death. So Sigmund Freud was also very interested in this question. And if we think about his famous Fort Dawes scene, which deals with the child whose mother has just left the child. I don't know how many of you remember this, but the mother has just left and the child throws a spool with thread out of the crib and then reels it back in and says, like, away, reels it back in, back again, away, back again, over and over and over. It's a repeated action. Freud, in this, when he writes about this, suggests that for the child, the mother's absence is death. That's what death means. And I found that really helpful in thinking about these kinds of absences that we're talking about here, where for the Inuit in those communities in the 1950s and 60s, the status of the family member in hospital, as dead or alive, would have been fundamentally uncertain, right? Still alive, probably dying, possibly dead without the message having arrived, not impossible. Very uncertain, right? So I also think that the everyday relationship between absence and death is illuminated here. Do we ever really know whether the people we love will come back to us dead or alive? I think all of us are in some ways like Freud's grandson, perhaps more than we like to admit. Absence is a certain kind of death, and we perform these kinds of rituals of throwing out the spool and pulling them back in. So in listening to the tapes, and maybe I'll just add another little line about Freud there. So Freud was really interested in the actual words, the fort and the da and their meanings, but I also became interested in just the sense of a word going out and a word coming back in, both in that scene, but also with the sound image that we hear here. So when I was listening to the tapes, the impossibility of saying something, of having something to say into that absence that is death became really palpable to me. And it's not to minimize the fact that there was certainly a sense of embarrassment, a shyness that came over someone speaking into a large and unfamiliar machine in the presence of a nurse who spoke very formally and, although kindly, also authoritatively into the recorder. But notwithstanding that, what is there exactly to say to someone who is absent or dead and who may or may not return, who is a child, a mother, and a lover? And it seems to me that the speakers ran up against, on the one hand, this impossibility of saying something, and on the other hand, the importance of saying something, the importance of speaking itself. So they lend their voices to this project, right? They, not knowing whether their words will reach the person they address, but also not knowing what to say. And so one of the things that I just want to ask is, what if the words themselves, as voicings or sound images, also go out and come back like that spool? What if the words themselves, independent of which words they are, insist that by speaking, there is the possibility of someone who is spoken to, dead or alive, who will be gathered up by the voice that goes out? So, and let me just say that again, despite everything, the Inuit lent their voices to the project. And so in a radical sense, I'm also trying to think here about the possibility that such sound images can actually conjure the spirits. So as Michael Taussig points out in his book on images and field notebooks, and anthropologists' field notebooks, and the book is called I Swear I Saw This, Colombian shamans make a similar link between the voice, the image the voice conjures, and the spirits. And so does the Arctic explorer Knud Rasmussen, whose reports of his fifth Thule expedition in the 1920s are really powerful reading. So Rasmussen, who was half Inuit himself, traveled by dog sled through the circumpolar Arctic in, as I said, the 1920s, and collected a wide material on a wide range of subjects. And in reading his material, his collection of Inuit poems and songs, one thing that is really stunning to me is the way that songs, or little bits of songs sometimes that he collected, are not understood as units of communication that should be coherent and understandable, but they're understood as familiar beings or as spirits. And so Rasmussen tells us that Orpingalik, the renowned Netsilik Inuit poet, shaman, and hunter of the 1920s, spoke of songs as his comrades in solitude. And so he explained to Rasmussen, songs are thoughts sung out with the breath when people are moved by great forces and ordinary speech no longer suffices. So I'll read that again. Songs are thoughts sung out with the breath when people are moved by great forces and ordinary speech no longer suffices. In those moments, we who always think of ourselves as small will feel still smaller, and we will fear to use words. But it will happen that the words we need will come of themselves. When the words we want to use shoot up of themselves, we get a new song. So songs, for Orpingalik's people, as for other Inuit that Rasmussen visited, swell up when ordinary speech is no longer adequate to the task. This means that songs, although they do refer to things in the world, are never straightforward acts of representation. Many of the songs that Rasmussen collected were composed at the time of death or disappearance of someone beloved. A man goes into self-imposed exile after killing another man, and a distraught mother says, as she begins to sing, "I recognize a bit of song, and I take it to me like a fellow being." So, as you noticed in the film, the Ituk, the man from Arctic Bay, says more than most of those who spoke into the tape recorder the nurse had brought with her. But still, he asserts, as so many of the speakers did, "I don't know what else to say at the moment. What news does it make sense to give? What is there to be said?" He wouldn't have known definitively, whether his words would reach his wife alive. But in the act of speaking, in the act of sending his words into the absence that is death, he, I'm arguing, calls a world into being, a world to which she belongs, dead or alive.
So Lisa, thank you so much. We want to ask you to kind of take us also through Life Beside Itself. And okay. I know that these two histories are so deeply intertwined for you. But I guess just to begin, and building upon what you just said with regard to kind of a communication that maybe extends beyond words and speech, could you talk to us a little bit about the ethic of being together, which pervades Life Beside Itself? And, mm-hmm. you know, like care is... Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about care as a form of listening, mm-hmm. Listening to uncertainty, listening to suffering. Could you just talk about...
Yeah, that's a really beautiful question. So one of the most important ways of being together in Inuit communities is in silence. And that is something that for our very chatty Southern Canadian culture is a difficult thing to get used to. So people will come into the house without knocking, sit down on the sofa, and no matter what somebody is doing in the house, nothing will change. They'll sit on the sofa and the person whose house they've entered will continue cooking, will continue watching TV, will continue sewing, whatever it is that they're doing. And that person who came and sat down on the sofa may get up again in half an hour, in 2 hours, may sleep the whole night there. And when they get up, they may leave again without ever having said a word, without asking permission to come in, without asking, you know, telling anybody where they're going. But the fact of being together in that same space is important, right? And so when you think then about the kind of violence, both say in the earlier tuberculosis epidemic that I treat in Life Beside Itself, and then later in the suicide epidemic that comes in the 1980s and continues, the kind of violence in the tuberculosis epidemic of removing people from that kind of situation where being with is one of the most important forms of care and of listening, and how difficult it was to be isolated on a hospital bed, right? So far away from your family members. And then I guess as I get into, much more in the book, the kind of violence of this anonymous care where there's a way of knowing that person that is so that comes in and sits on your couch, right, in this example that I'm giving, that is so profoundly specific. And the violence of this anonymous care is that when the person arrives, you know, calls a suicide hotline or arrives at a counselor's office, they're profoundly generic. And I think, understanding the kind of depth of that alternative form of care in the Arctic helps to understand both why the tuberculosis epidemic had such long and devastating impacts on the history of the Inuit people. Does that make sense?
In a way, like as we've been talking about the experience of reading Life Beside Itself and in the reading group as well, and there's like an extraordinary compassion that like suffuses your writing, but also that ethic of being together. And but at the same time, it also is it also a critique of the anthropological method and ethnographic method? Could you talk us through kind of your own position?
Is my writing a critique of the ethnographic method?
Yeah, like, and how do you, like, as you enact that ethic of being together, mm-hmm. Can you talk about mm-hmm. your own mm-hmm. subject
well,
position?
Well, okay, that's also a really difficult but beautiful question. So... the way that I practice anthropology, you know, came to me out of necessity. It was the only way, if I was going to practice anthropology, I could practice anthropology. And so what anthropology means to me is an ability to be able to be with and to have this, and to be able to listen, as I say in the book, listen differently, which means to, for me, it means to be able to listen to the stories that don't follow the chronological or the expected narrative, that don't have the familiar subject-verb predicate, that kind of the stories that flash up and aren't supposed to be told, right? And so for me, it's a kind of attentiveness that develops, and I think it could develop for anybody in that kind of situation. I think that the Canadian Arctic at this moment in history demands it, right? Because the complicated, the violence of colonialism is so difficult to point your finger at, because the Canadian state agents at the time of the colonialization, which sort of ramped up in the 1940s and 50s, you know, said to each other, we don't want to make the same mistakes as we made with the Indigenous people in southern Canada. We want to do the right thing by our Inuit population. And so there was this whole rhetoric of compassion and care coming from the Canadian state agents who were colonizing the Inuit. On top of that, it was not the same form of colonization that occurred in the South that people like Audra Simpson and Patrick Wolfe have written about so beautifully, where land is life. And so if you take away people's land, it's genocide, whether you want to call it that or not. But the strange thing in the Canadian Arctic is that the Canadians were worried about the sovereignty of the Arctic, and so they wanted to make sure there were healthy bodies on that they could call Canadian on Canadian soil. And so the tuberculosis treatment of the Inuit was also to make sure that there were healthy Canadian bodies, right? And so in the context of that, you can see how it would be very difficult for a young Inuit teenager today to be able to put a finger on what hurts. I'm hurt, but what hurts? My mother is hurt, but what hurt my mother? And so I think in this context, you have to be able to listen differently. And so I think one really helpful example of this for me is the story of the shooting of the dogs, where there was an anthropologist, actually, who was up in the Canadian Arctic, and those of you who've read the book will be familiar, but just to kind of really ground this in an example. So there's an anthropologist, he's doing interviews on the transition to wage labor. The RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, start shooting the Inuit sled dogs that were the dogs that took Inuit from these communities where they were being gathered by the Canadian state back out to their traditional hunting lands. And they were the only connection to that way of life that was, they were being told to leave by the Canadian state in order to receive better health care, receive better education, and receive welfare. They said, you know, you really need to come into these settlements. And so he's doing this interview about wage labor. They shoot the dogs. And so he starts asking a question on his schedule about the shooting of the dogs. And most people don't answer. They say, I don't know. Because this anthropologist is also seen partly as an agent of the state, right? But one man, Davidy, says, and it's a very, I have the tape of this too, and it's really fascinating to listen to because, again, it happens all through translation, right? There's a, and it's a very kind of muddled conversation and really interesting to listen to because the translator keeps saying, Davidy is saying that Inuit dogs, same thing. And the anthropologist is like, what? What do you mean Inuit and dogs, same thing? Inuit and dogs, same thing, one. And he's like, what do you mean that the, you know, and he goes on with all of these that almost, I mean, they're almost ridiculous, although what saves the whole conversation is at the end, finally the anthropologist gets it, and he says, oh, David E. also says in the course of this, in great frustration, he says, no, Inuit, okay, RCMP shoot Inuit next. And he's like, what do you mean? RCMP shoot Inuit dogs. No, RCMP shoot Inuit next. And it's this amazing kind of drama of colonialism, right? Where this anthropologist is not understanding, can't even enter his mind frame that this man might be saying that I picture that we might be next. And so the thing is that, I mean, there was, as one of the people in the film says, there was no program to stamp out Canadian Inuit, but the psychic life of the killing of those dogs was like killing the Inuit. And David E. is telling us a truth when he says they're going to shoot the Inuit next, because that is a truth about the psychic reality of that act, right? And so, now I can't remember what that example was grounding. I thought it was very grounding of the point that I was making. But does anybody remember? Oh, so yes. So in this particular moment, you have to be able to listen to these stories that seem preposterous, right? Because it doesn't fit with the colonial narrative. You have to listen and hear because he can't tell it in any kind of other way. He tells it through these images, like they're shooting, I picture them shooting the Inuit people next. That's what I picture. That's what this act means. And so having that kind of attentiveness, I think, is essential in these situations of coloniality and colonial violence. That makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, going off of that, I was reading in the introduction to Life Beside Itself, the anecdote that you give about the raven.
Right.
And just to like give a brief description, you know, in the book, Lisa describes a scene where an Inuit teen sees a raven in the backyard, and that raven is the reincarnation of a dead grandfather. And there's sort of like an uncertainty as to whether or not the raven is or is not the grandfather. And it doesn't particularly matter whether or not the raven is the grandfather, because it means something that it is a raven and it is there in the backyard. And you talk about holding the value of life in abeyance, mm-hmm. in that moment, mm-hmm. that in order to understand what it means to like witness the suffering and to like really hold space for, mm-hmm. another person means necessarily like holding space in one's own mind to like renegotiate, mm-hmm. our value systems, mm-hmm. and that's difficult enough for an individual person to do when talking, mm-hmm. to another individual person,
right.
But how do we incorporate that thing then on a systemic level? Like, mm-hmm. what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. So, that was such a generously put question. I think, so that in that moment that you're describing, and as you say, that moment of my interlocutor, I'm doing the anthropologist thing. So it was really your grandfather, right? And he says, I don't know, the raven's still there. Right, not telling me yes, it was, or no, it wasn't, but the raven is still there, the materiality of that bird is still there, right? And it seems like in the same way that we need to trouble our sense of identity, it is or it isn't my grandfather, we need to trouble what it means to be alive and what it means to be dead. And in a suicide epidemic, that is the thing that we, as people who are compassionate, don't want to trouble, right? We want to say, staying alive matters. It's the most important thing. And all of the suicide programs in the Arctic, during the time that I was doing my field work, were oriented in that direction. Keep people alive. There was a big poster that said, Inuit survive, stay alive, right? Stay alive. And yet, these campaigns were not touching the youth that I was working with, right? In fact, at certain moments, I did in a kind of experimental theater group with some of them at one point, and they, the theater director said, okay, I want you to pretend that you're talking to the social worker at school, and the Inuit guy went like this. And it was a really interesting moment for me, because the theater director, who was coming from Vancouver and hadn't worked with Inuit before, was hoping to have like a good story about like talking to the social worker at school and how that might help. And the youth that I were working with really felt like, I stay away from me. This is, there's some way in which what you are saying, I just want to keep at a distance. And so that was my provocation in some way as an anthropologist to understand, like, what's happening here? How, why are these messages being experienced as incredibly violent in some way? And part of it, I come to understand, is that the Inuit youth that I was working with didn't see life and death as these polar opposites, and had conversations with their dead friends in dreams, continued sort of, and that relationship kept evolving in many ways too. And so once you see that they're holding the value of life in itself, the physical life that the Canadian state is so desperately trying to protect, I think you understand something about the conundrum of that kind of moment in the Canadian Arctic.
Yeah.
And it helps to look at the tuberculosis epidemic and then the suicide epidemic, because you see the same kind of value of life itself happening in the tuberculosis epidemic. We want to save these lives, but we don't actually care who they are. We're going to forget all their names. We're going to bury them in unmarked graves, right? But as many lives as we can save. And so I think at some kind of really deep level, there's also a resistance to, this is the way you want me to be alive, right? You want me to stay alive for the sake of staying alive. If I'm going to stay alive, it's going to be for some other reason.
Right.
Yeah.
And going off of that, in the beginning you talked about the violence of friendliness, and mm-hmm. you talk about that extensively in the book. I guess, can you just talk more about
the violence of friendliness?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I as I say, I have a very difficult time watching this film, and it's because of that violence of friendliness and the colonial voices that I made the decision to put in there. And as I was saying, I was trying to make a film that spoke through its form as well as its content. And so I was trying to hold those voices or position those voices in a certain way so that the absurdity of it would be evident, right? And so you have a woman saying, oh, it's okay, we get along just fine. We have a few translations of like hi and goodbye, and that's about it. We don't need anything else, right? And then you see the kids like waving with these smiles on their face, right? And so you get in a visual image the way that young Inuit will put on a smile for the authorities, right? And the person behind the camera at that moment is a doctor who's up. Some doctors went on the RCMP patrol thinking of it as like a paid way to go on a great cruise, right? And so they took their cameras with them and took, that's the footage that we see in the film. It's from doctors on the boat. And so that violence of friendliness, then you get another Arctic administrator saying like, I have friends all over the Arctic. Like, I only stay there a week, but I have these great friends, right? And in this incredible colonial tract that the RCMP handed out as they began bringing people into settlements that's called the Book of Wisdom for Eskimos. And it has all of these like pictures and instructions to Inuit on how to live. And one of the images is of the RCMP, you know, striding forward, and it says RCMP, the Eskimo's friend. And so there was this insistence that these colonial agents were friends, right? And so I think it's important to actually hear what the friends said, right? And to hear them when they say, you know, you can't actually be civilized without being able to read, right? And then you hear Rasmussen talking about the poems and these songs that surge up at moments. I mean, this incredible philosophy, right, embedded in the oral tradition. So that's the violence of friendliness. I don't know. It's a term that came to me only recently, the violence of friendliness. And I keep thinking that I should rename the film The Limits of Language, because there's that colonial, within the limits of language, we're friends, you know. So I should rename the film The Limits of Language, and then I should really write something on this violence of friendliness, because I think, but you know, that's how it is with projects. You keep understanding them.
Continuing on that and that conversation around the violence of friendliness, I was hoping we could go back to the anonymity of care, as you've both just spoken about it, but also in Life Beside Itself. And in a way, my question is like two-part. One, you know, in that book, you talk about the anonymity of care not just as being obsessed with the preservation of life, mm-hmm. But you also talk about it as murderous.
Right.
And you talk about, particularly in the case of the youth suicide epidemic, is exacerbating rather mm-hmm. than mitigating mm-hmm. the suicide epidemic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so anonymity of care becomes not just a colonial, it's not just a colonial project from the past, but it continues in new forms mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it's not genteel, it's not mm-hmm. just kind of mistake, mm-hmm. it's not just friendly mm-hmm. In a violent way, it's murderous mm-hmm, in every sense. And so I was wondering if you could talk about that, if mm-hmm. this film in a way, and the book mm-hmm. critiques that mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very explicitly, but also, and this is the second part of the kind of question or the invitation to talk about that, but and perhaps this is kind of a problematic, in a way, question, but like, can we universalize from that mm-hmm. experience to talk about healthcare mm-hmm. Today, mm-hmm. More generally in the U.S. and mm-hmm. Canada and mm-hmm. beyond? Like, is there something about, can we extract from that discussion of mm-hmm. anonymous care in the mm-hmm. Arctic, can we extract mm-hmm. from that kind of a mm-hmm. larger critique of how care is, mm-hmm. you know, enacted and mm-hmm. performed mm-hmm. kind mm-hmm. of in the West?
So. Yeah. So I think, so the two parts of the question. First, the murderousness of anonymous care. So in what sense is it murderous? Well, the issue is that, you know, we have social security numbers in Canada. We have them in social identification. We call them almost the same thing in the U.S. And, you know, we don't get too bothered about them. But the interesting thing in the Inuit case is that the Canadian state wanted them to wear them as dog tags around their necks at all times, right? And so it wasn't just that you had a number that you could use in certain bureaucratic situations, it's that you were reduced to a number. Your being was, in some sense, that number. And to get at the murderousness of that is not simple, right? You have to hear these kinds of stories like David E. telling you, actually, this colonial regime is murderous. It says that it's helping. It says that it's trying to, you know, the rationale for the RCMP for shooting the dogs was that they were a public health threat, right? So they're trying to keep us alive, but in fact, they're trying to kill off who we are, not what we are as physical bodies, but they're killing off who we are. And the Inuit don't want to separate those two things, right? I think we've become very adept in more bureaucratic cultures at separating and partitioning off our bureaucratic selves from something else that we want to call our true selves. And we kind of walk into a doctor's office and shelve that kind of whole self and are treated as this kind of physical body that needs to be kept alive, right? So yeah, I do think that you can extrapolate to forms of bureaucratic care and, you know, bureaucratic care and the way that it can feel murderous. I haven't done research into that in any extensive way, but I just know from my own moving through the world how alienating it can be, right, when you encounter these forms of care in our own southern societies.
I mean, in the book you also talk about the hotlines as kind of this well-intentioned,
country club.
Kind of populated by individuals who, you know, want to do good, but in fact, again, continue kind of a longer.
They were really difficult. Yeah, and I volunteered on the hotline, and it was a group of really super well-intentioned people. And the people who started it are wonderful people. And that's what's hard. That's what's really hard about. And that's why I also don't know what to call this period in Arctic history. Like, should I still be using the word colonial? Because so many of these structures are still the same, right? So is it post-colonial? In certain senses, because the Inuit have succeeded in negotiating a land claim with the Canadian government and have a new territory since 1999 called Nunavut, and the incredible political significance of that shouldn't be overlooked. But at the same time, the same bureaucratic structures are in place. So it's like a kind of colonial afterlife, right? So I lost my train of thought. the hotline. So they were really wonderful people, but so much of the mode of thinking was all of the mode of thinking. It was absolutely permeated with this sense of anonymously doing good, and it doesn't matter who it is. In fact, if I hear who it is, I pretend I don't know who it is. It's like that is what it means to be professional, and that is what it means to truly care, that it doesn't matter who you are sitting in front of me. And so I was a volunteer on that hotline, and the reality is that no one calls it. I spent many shifts, and I got probably 2 calls, and mostly, you know, yeah. So it's a very, very underutilized resource. And when I, you know, would ask people why they thought they were, you know, people in the Inuit community, they gave me point blank, you know, we are not an anonymous culture. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sort of just sitting with that right now. Yeah. What to do? What to do about that thing?
Yeah, and I mean, so in the Canadian Arctic and in the Canadian healthcare system, I think the important thing is for the doctors that go north, right, and spend. So it still has that system where young doctors will go and spend like a year or 2 years in the Canadian Arctic and then leave, right? And I think we need to work towards different kinds of trainings for the people that are going north, And what do we do on a systemic global level about the kind of bureaucratization of the self, and is a larger question that I don't know that I can answer tonight.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because this hello, okay. As you're talking about the sort of anonymous form of care and the bureaucratization of the selves, I'm thinking about not just the Inuit community that you're talking about in Canada, but I'm even thinking about like my job.
Right.
You know, I work in a psychiatry mm-hmm. department, and I'm thinking about just the way in which we interact with people, mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and the ways in which we ask questions mm-hmm. of people, and the types of listening mm-hmm. we're engaged in, and mm-hmm. the standardization of questions, yeah. and all of that. You know.
Yeah.
When yeah. it really comes down to it, it's me and another person in a room, mm-hmm. or it's two people, two bodies in a room, mm-hmm. and we're engaged mm-hmm. in a conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm really just like struck by this thing, I think, constantly, mm-hmm. that it really is as simple as two people in a room.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think about that in terms of anthropology. For me, being a form of self-fashioning, in some way, that it, you know, I'm constantly trying to work on myself to be open to these moments or flashes where you recognize the presence of an other. And it, I don't mean that it can happen all the time, or that I don't get with, you know, I'm at a public university in Canada. I teach introductory classes with 300 students. And there is a certain way in which it's very difficult to hold on to that sense when, you know, the everyday kind of stresses of life, a student comes in and is frustrated about a grade, and I have this overwhelming feeling that they're just trying to get me to change their grade, right? And you want to treat them not like you have, but how do we make ourselves open to the flash of another person in the room? That's what, and I think that anthropology at its best allows for that kind of self-fashioning.
Maybe one last question, and then open it up. Can you talk about how your work is situated in the larger kind of landscape right now in Canada, as to kind of the politics of remembrance and forgetting? Mm-hmm. Like, is this film a form of activism, to the extent that it mm-hmm. enables a process of remembrance and acknowledgement that is otherwise kind of just not happening? Like, can you talk about, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, is your work a bulk work against forgetting? Maybe not mm-hmm. within the Inuit community, mm-hmm. but maybe mm-hmm. beyond, more generally, Canadian
yeah.
national culture?
Well, I think it's a question. I mean, it's a question about the future of the film and how it finds audiences. And so it, I only finished it in October, and so I haven't yet figured out how to do this kind of distribution. But I think there's a kind of real openness in Canada at the moment to try to think differently about our colonial past. And for instance, in the anthropology department at McGill, we were just authorized to, you know, to have two lines. That's two jobs in Indigenous anthropology, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but McGill is a bastion of conservatism in the Canadian landscape, and it means everything that we're going to hire two Indigenous scholars into our department, right? So there's this opening. And my sister-in-law, an Inuit woman, was just saying, like, she, you know, burst out in anger at something that wasn't, you know, burst out in anger at a certain moment. And she said to me, you know, it's just that at the moment we're starting to talk about these things, and we're starting to understand, like, she was angry at something other. Right? And she said, we're starting to talk about these things, and I'm starting to understand where my mother and my grandmother's anger came from, and I don't know how to channel the anger at the moment. So this is the kind of like really uncomfortable moment is like we're getting to recognize, hopefully, the violence of friendliness, and hopefully that language can help kind of put a name on something that's so hard to put a name on. Because I think what she is having a hard time with, and her mother and her grandmother before her, is it's really difficult. We have this anger, but we don't know how to name where it's coming from. So that's what I hope that this can help with.